Why are more women than ever choosing Natural Cycles? The hormone-free, side-effect-free way to take control of your fertility. Natural Cycles is a birth control app that uses your temperature to find your fertile window. It is more than a basic cycle tracking app. Natural Cycles is the only FDA-cleared and CE-marked birth control app and has helped millions prevent and plan for pregnancy naturally. Save 15% when you sign up today with code RADIO15. Learn more at naturalcycles.com.
Failed ya. Welcome to the Village Oak Tree. I'm your host, Terrence O'Donnell, and thank you for joining me once again. As promised, I have my Canadian friend with me this week to talk about the war in Sudan. I say with me as in she's doing remote. She offered me a podcast file that I've created for you, so she's going to be hanging in the background. I'll be bringing you some history as to why the war started and where it stands today. And my friend Sam will be talking about the humanitarian crisis all this has caused, especially since Trump recently cut aid money for the NGOs in the area with the closing of USAID. Once we presented our case to you in order to bring awareness to all these atrocities, I would ask everyone to stick around to my commercial break to hear another chapter of The Priest by Michael Campy. So come, pull up a chair, and let us tell you a little bit about the war in Sudan that the North American media isn't telling you. So what I want to do is I want to talk about how it all started. So for the past 2 years, Sudan has been devastated by another civil war. This time it's between the RSF, called the Rapid Support Forces, and the Sudanese Armed Forces, supposedly the country's regular army. These two military groups once shared the government before falling out in April 2023 that erupted into open warfare, and they have been rampaging the region ever since. The dispute supposedly started over arguments about the timeline of integrating the two military factions together. I'm going to read from this article in RT News, Russia, that gives us a good idea of how this began and where it stands today. It's dated from back in January, but it sums it all up pretty nicely. So let me bring that article up here for you. And I'm going to go over here and I'm going to read it. Land of war. Two generals clash in the heart of Africa. Should the world prepare for the worst? So let me blow this up here a little bit for you. So maybe you can read it a little bit more. And I'm going to kind of roll down through this. The latest news from Sudan, now you remember, this is dated January 26th. The latest news from Sudan shows the country is still a long way from transitioning to civilian rule. Since April of 2023, the conflict has been ongoing in Sudan. The two largest armed groups, the Sudan Armed Forces, SAF, led by de facto head of state, chairman of the Sudan, Transitional Sovereign Council Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, controlled by Deputy Chairman Mohamed Hamdan Daglo Hamedi. At the heart of the conflict is a power struggle between the Sudan's power centers, which seek to maintain dominance and within access to key economic resources in a future Sudan controlled by civilians. Background of the conflict. Since independence in 1956, Sudan has remained a highly unstable country with a significant role for the military and politics. This is reflected in the fact that it has faced 35 attempted military coups, of which 6 have been successful. The last 2 coups in 2019 and 2021 have directly affected the current state of affairs. Sudan has been under the rule of Omar al-Bashir since 1989. Prolonged conflicts with rebels during al-Bashir's rule favored the creation of new armed groups that existed alongside the Sudanese armed forces. These were made up of militias that were able to fight the rebels in return for control of financial activities in the areas of influence. Thus, one side of today's conflict in Sudan, the RSF grew out of an Arab tribal militia in Darfur and was officially recognized in 2013, reporting to the National Intelligence Security Service, becoming the largest and most significant of such groups. These groups were also used by al-Bashir's political regime to balance the Sudanese army and complicate the possibility of a military coup. Nevertheless, the sharp worsening of Sudan's financial crisis in 2018, triggered by a growing currency shortage, led to a reduction in government spending, which caused a significant rise in food prices and triggered a political crisis. The situation was fueled by the Sudanese street's desire for a change in political leadership, being tired of the 30-year rule of al-Bashir, who was preparing to run again in the 2020 presidential election. All this provoked large-scale protests in the country, which began in December 2018 and lasted for more than 4 months. Against this background, the military, previously loyal to the president, in fact sided with the protesters and carried out a military coup in Sudan in April 2019, removing the longtime leader from power and forming a transitional military council with General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan as its head. The military leaders thus prevented a civil revolution in the country by keeping in power, for the most part, the same military figures who had been close to al-Bashir and began to delay the transition process, making relations with civilian forces tense. In August 2019, with the mediation of Ethiopia, the African Union, and IGAD, Sudan established a supreme civil military authority, the Transitional Sovereign Council of Sudan, headed by al-Burhan and his deputy RSF chief, Hamedti, which appointed a civilian prime minister, Abdallah Hamdok. During the transitional process in October 2020, the transitional authorities concluded an agreement with Darfur rebel groups in Juba, the capital of South Sudan, which is supposed to end the conflict in Darfur. Moreover, Sudan was removed from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism, which should have facilitated investment activity in the country. Despite this, unity and stability in the political process failed to be achieved. The situation was complicated by risk within the civilian and military leadership, as well as attempts by the civilian authorities to conduct anti-corruption investigations against the country's military leaders. This situation led to another military coup in October 2021, when the Sudanese military authorities took advantage of the split in the civilian coalition to remove Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok and other members of the government. However, renewed protests and negative reactions from the international community, including the UN, the African Union, and the previously military-supporting UAE and Saudi Arabia, forced the military to restore a civilian government, but the political process remained complicated. Conflict sides. In December 2022, Sudan's military and civilian leaders signed a preliminary agreement to end military rule and transition to full civilian rule. However, contradictions within the armed forces and directly between the chairman of the Transitional Sovereign Council of Sudan, al-Burhan, and his deputy, Hamedti, had now become visible. Key point of dispute over the specifics of the transition process was the issue of where the RSF fit into the hierarchy of the Sudanese armed forces and the duration of the transitional process, effectively highlighting the problem of power sharing between the armed groups. The head of the SAF, al-Burhan, insisted on the need to integrate the RSF into the SAF within 2 years, emphasizing the need for them to be fully accountable to the leadership of the SAF. Hamedti, on the other hand, favored bringing the RSF directly under the control of the Sovereign Council, civilian forces, and extended the transition process to a 10-year period. The dispute between the generals, along with fears of a transition to civilian rule, was also based on financial considerations. Hamedti, the head of the RSF, one of the most influential politicians in the country, has concentrated up to 100,000 trained soldiers under his command, who have undertaken several military campaigns both inside Sudan and in Yemen and Libya, where they were funded by the UAE and Saudi Arabia. In addition, the RSF hold an important source of foreign exchange, gold mines in Darfur. They control Sudan's border to the west with Chad and Libya, and participate in regional smuggling. The Sudanese armed forces, led by al-Burhan, also rely on strong economic base through the creation of large companies run directly by the military and not accountable to civilian structures. This position allowed them to concentrate significant resources in their hands, accounting for up to 80% of Sudan's economy. and to have representation in all sectors, including agriculture, logistics, banking, mining, and construction. These broad economic interests of the Arab groups explain not only the prolongation of the transition process, but also the reluctance of the generals to leave their positions in the transitional government, losing control over the financial rents. In addition, the rivalry between the two sides was also affected by the historical opposition between the poor Arab groups of Western Sudan, RSF, and the Arab elites of the Nile, representing SAF. All of this made their differences unresolvable, triggering an armed conflict in mid-April 2023. Foreign influence. The Sudanese crisis is also complicated by the complex regional balance of power influenced by the situation in Sudan. Traditionally, the Gulf monarchies had the most important leverage. The main sponsors of the 2019 military coup and active investors in the country, the UAE and Saudi Arabia, play an important role in the current crisis. While the Saudis act as an international mediator, the Emiratis are more likely to support the RSF, with those leaders Abu Dhabi has built deep economic ties with. UAE support for RSF is evident, both in reported arms shipments through Chad and Libya and through financial flows, as the UAE remains the most important gold trading destination for the RSF. Despite the level of relations with Al Burhan being good prior to the present conflict, it is likely that it occurred.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
In the current environment, UAE leadership saw an opportunity to maximize their gains in the event of Hamidi strengthening his position post-conflict Sudan. The UAE choice of side is also confirmed by the diplomatic crisis with the Sudanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, controlled by the Sudanese Armed Forces, which demanded the departure of 15 Emirati diplomats from Sudan in December of 2023. Saudi Arabia, in an effort to maintain security in the Red Sea region and protect its investments in Sudan, became one of the most important mediators between the parties to the conflict by providing a platform of negotiations in Jeddah. It is noteworthy that the Jeddah talks were also held with the support of the U.S., whose influence in Sudan is limited, as evidenced by the protracted crisis, and its interests are based in supporting a transition to civilian rule, which is hardly possible today. Besides, the crisis in Sudan is not a priority for U.S. diplomacy. The other Arab regional leader, Egypt, interested in stabilizing its southern borders, on the contrary, actively supports the Sudanese armed forces, due to both the closer personal relationship between the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and Sudan's transitional Sovereign Council Chairman Al Burhan, and the similarity of their political regimes controlled by the military. In addition, Egypt's interest is noted in seeking Sudan's support for its position in the Nile Dam dispute with Ethiopia and fears of an intensifying refugee crisis on its southern borders. It is therefore not surprising that Egyptian pilots have been supporting the Sudanese armed forces since the beginning of the conflict, and Egypt itself has been politically aligned with the SAF. So here's a map. This is Sudan's areas controlled by rival forces. So if you're having a little, let me kind of spell this out for you. Everything in brown is controlled by SAF. Everything in green is controlled by RSF. And the little squares with the black checks inside are contested territories. The African Union and the Intergovernmental Authority for Development, IGAD, have been involved in attempts at a negotiation process and have put forward their own initiatives. China is also not taking sides, but is interested in stability in Sudan, having made large investments in the country's economy, signed an agreement with Khartoum to participate in the Belt and Road Initiative. Russia, which has traditionally enjoyed friendly relations based on mutually beneficial agriculture and arms trade, is also in favor of an early resolution of the crisis. the development of the conflict in Sudan. The fighting that erupted in the capital Khartoum, then spread to the other regions of Sudan, did not immediately lead to a sustainable advantage for one of the warring parties. The resolution of the conflict between the military groups was complicated by a major stalemate, the inability of the opposing forces to launch a decisive offensive and turn the conflict in their favor. Among other things, rebel groups in Darfur gradually joined the parties. The situation made it difficult to find a compromise to achieve peace, as both sides felt that they could gain an advantage in the fighting continued. Therefore, numerous attempts at a ceasefire agreement brokered by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. and Jeddah, even those agreed upon by both warring parties, collapsed. Sudan's territory was gradually divided into two zones controlled by the warring parties. The leadership of the SAF deployed in the east in the city of Port Sudan and retained control of the central and eastern provinces of the country, the Nile River north of Khartoum, and the most important Red Sea ports. The RSF, on the other hand, with a key zone of influence in western Sudan, gradually consolidated control over most of Darfur, a large part of Khartoum state, and territories in the north and west Kordofan. Against the backdrop of renewed talks in Jeddah in October, the RSF managed to capture the town of Niala, a major logistical center in Darfur, which began to tip the balance in RSF's favor. It once again led to the postponing of peace talks, however, due to the strengthening of one of the sides. In November and December, the situation continued to evolve, leading to the RSF taking control of Wad Madani, the capital of Gezira region, it's an important logistics and food center, which could lead to a disruption of supply to the SAF. The RSF quick capture of the town also demonstrated the lack of unity and limited ability of the SAF to conduct an effective military campaign in the current environment. Direct talks between Hemedti and Al-Burhan were scheduled to take place in Djibouti in late December, mediated by IGAD. But the day before the agreed meeting was due to take place, the RSF chief declined to attend, traveling on a regional tour to consolidate his international position. During this tour, Hemedti visited Uganda, Ethiopia, Djibouti, Kenya, and South Africa, and held meetings with the presidents and foreign ministers of these states, as well as Sudanese civilian leaders. In this way, Hemedti added a new political and diplomatic dimension to the conflict and expressed readiness for a peaceful resolution on terms more favorable to the RSF. Burhan responded by announcing his suspension from IGAD, claiming violation of Sudan's sovereignty by the organization. To summarize, Sudan's military-centric system of governments is unlikely to change to civilian leadership in the near future. Rather, civilian forces will continue to be dependent on armed groups. The Sudanese conflict itself is currently passing through a crucial stage. The RSF's growing strength makes its negotiating position much more favorable. The reinforcement of these gains by the RSF leaders' international contacts, however, discourages the SAF from negotiating. At the same time, the inability of the parties to reach an agreement brings Sudan closer to the risk of becoming a failed state, which would increase the destabilization not only in Sudan itself, but also neighboring countries and regions, including the Horn of Africa, the Sahel, and Egypt. Increasing tensions in a weakening army could lead to the proliferation of women's weapons to groups that would become an even greater security challenge in a region already facing significant challenges. The situation in Sudan remains acute with a growing humanitarian crisis that has affected much of the country during the conflict. It was also influenced by the uncontrolled actions of both sides' troops, which are involved in looting and violence against civilians. As of January 2024, the number of civilian deaths has exceeded 10,000, and more than 7.2 million people have been forced to leave their homes and escape the hostilities, of whom more than 1.5 million have also left Sudan. These figures show that Sudan is now a country with the largest number of displaced persons in the world and one of the worst humanitarian crises. And this is from Andrei Shelkovnikov, expert at the Center of African Affairs, HSC University. So basically, what we're talking about here, and as like I said, this is a really good article to give you an idea of what's going on. So the goal for RSF now here. This is obviously April, but here we are in April, and their goal is to establish an Arab emirate at some point around Darfur with the help from some mercenaries from neighboring African nations and certain Arab nations. Obviously, General Burhan and the Sudanese armed forces are fighting to stop that. What it's looking like is another classic battle between Western colonialism, or what's left of it, versus the Arab tribes in the region who won independence from the West. The West and the Gulf states don't want to lose access to all the resources in the area, such as the seaports and mineral wealth that they want to continue to exploit for themselves, along with the rich elites in the Sudanese government, such as it is. As I said, there is no civilian government anymore, but they would like to have control of everything. So I have some more articles, mostly from RT News, because the Russians have been trying to mediate this war and bring it to a halt. I want to kind of highlight certain portions of these articles, to try and bring an idea where they are at this point in the negotiations. So let me pull up these next two articles here. And this one is the title, Land of Mass Graves and Mercenaries, Can This Genocide Be Stopped? As I said, it's entered its third war now. And what I want to kind of bring up here, just basically this front part. In February, a charter was signed in Nairobi, the capital of Kenya, establishing a parallel government of peace and unity in Sudan in opposition to the Transitional Sovereign Council and the Sudanese Armed Forces. Now, I mentioned these in the previous article. Ceremony organized by the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, was attended by various political parties and armed groups. I'm not going to go over this next part here, but I will talk about it a little bit. Here, given the situation in the battlefield, the fact that international legal organizations and countries, including the U.S., accuse the RSF of initiating ethnic cleansing, the success of the initiative is questionable. However, the agreement reached in Nairobi poses a threat of further division in Sudan, as the RSF still controls large territories in the west and south. There's a whole lot more in here, and it goes on a little more about the generals and all that kind of stuff. Here's another look at the map. Here we are. And this article is dated. Let me roll back up here. This is dated 9 April. So if you look at this map now, here, as of 9 April, you'll see that the green and the brown are a little bit different. And now you have other rebel groups that are expanding their territorial reach in these gray areas. So that could prove to be a problem.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Problem as well. So as I said here, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to share this next article. This one's dated 10 April. Russia and Sudan discuss crisis in African country. Moscow's deputy foreign minister met with the Sudanese ambassador, discuss urgent steps towards ending the conflict. Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov has held talks with the Sudanese ambassador to Moscow, Mohammed Siraj, to discuss the ongoing conflict. The idea is they're trying to get a ceasefire going, but as I said, the RSF is having issues with this. They can't seem to come to terms. And it goes on to a little bit more. So I won't talk about this here, but I am going to bring up this last article here, though. How U.S. policy, let me pull this up here. How U.S. policy is hindering peace in a war-torn African country. And this talks a little bit about what the U.S. is doing. And it talks about Washington. Now, you got to understand, this is from a Russian perspective. But this is written by Mohammed Abd al-Wahid Mohammed Hussein. He's a teaching assistant of political science, but he's working in Russia. So you understand, it's from a Russian perspective. And it might be a bit biased. You know, it talks more about the war, the history of the war, 12 million people. Geneva talks organized by last month by Anthony Blinken. Well, you know, this is dated April. That can't have been last month because Blinken lost his job back in January. So again, it gives you an idea. So let me talk a little bit about what this says here. A consultative meeting was held in last July. A declaration signed, and so on. Okay, that's more history. You already know about the history. And it just talks about, I'm kind of on a roll down. Basically, there's not much in here. And, you know, the fact that Blinken tried to do something about this. So I won't bore you with the rest of this. But let's talk about what's going on with the rest of this. So now you have a good idea what's going on over there from a military point of view. Let me offer you the humanitarian perspective from my young friend and Canadian activist, Sam W., who has graciously offered her take on the situation of all the helpless Sudanese refugees caught up in this endless warfare that's been going on in this part of Africa for decades, from Ethiopia to Somalia and now the Sudan. I created this small video using her audio file that she made for today's show with her permission. For more of her excellent writings on activism of all kinds, I invite everyone to visit her Substack page at worldweary.com to read more and listen to her occasional audio podcast. So let me bring up her here.
There's a fantastic scene from MASH that perfectly encapsulates the situation in Sudan. Now, if you're too young to know what MASH is, don't worry, I got you. It's an older television show that ran for about 9 years through the 1970s and early 1980s. The show's name stands for Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, and it's a war drama with a great splash of comedy and loads of social commentary that still holds up today. Now, I'm too young to have watched MASH while it was airing. Hell, my mother is a bit too young to have watched it while it was airing. But still, it remains a cultural touchstone for many people across North America. It follows the antics of a small group of field surgeons and doctors stationed in Weijungbo during the Korean War. In the particular scene that I'm thinking of, several of the characters are in the middle of performing surgery on a wounded man. Now, you don't need to know the characters or their backgrounds or any of the context to understand the point of the scene. Here's a short transcript of the conversation. Captain Hawkeye says, "You know, war isn't hell. War is war, and hell is hell. And of the two, war is a lot worse." Father McCauley asks, "Well, how do you figure, Hawkeye?" And Hawkeye responds, "It's easy, Father. Tell me, who goes to hell?" Father McCauley says, "It's sinners, I believe." And Hawkeye says, "Exactly. There are no innocent bystanders in hell. War is chock full of them. There's little kids, cripples, old ladies. In fact, except for some of the brass, almost everybody involved is an innocent bystander." Now, while studying events in Sudan, this scene rolled through my mind like the tolling of a bell. Because Hawkeye was correct. War is worse than hell. Now, I've never fought in a war myself. That experience is something that I can't speak to. But what I do know is that when conflict breaks out, it's never the people giving orders from the rear who have to suffer. It's the innocent civilians caught in the crossfire of other men's ambitions and rage. Sudan is currently the site of one of the worst humanitarian crises in modern history, with around 13 million people displaced from their homes and forced to flee their homeland. Between the conflict of the civil war and the ravages of climate change, they have no choice but to seek safety elsewhere. Staying close to home and riding out the strife is no longer an option. For many of these people, home no longer exists. Now, this is bad enough for adults, but children have it far worse. Instability is a nightmare for small children, and a loss of familiarity is extremely traumatic. anyone who's tried to move homes with small children understands that losing their homes and going out into an uncertain world is scary for children on its own. But interruptions in education, food, and clean water supplies can be absolutely devastating. The more stress and scarcity are heaped on already struggling families, the more they have to fear. The more rough terrain and conflict they must experience, the greater their chances of injury and loss. In these conditions, both their physical and mental well-being are at risk. And those risks are compounded by the fact that we are swiftly approaching an extremely dangerous time of year to be on the road. The rainy season is on its way, and with it come the lean times. The lean season in Sudan is the period between harvests, usually lasting between the start of April and the end of June. It's a critical time of year for food assistance, especially with the unreliable planting season they've seen over the past few years. With the usual cycle of planting and harvest no longer possible in many regions, most people are unable to survive on stored foods the way they would have been able to do so in years prior. Coupled with the rainy season, where the landscape can change radically in an instant and local infrastructure is left shaky at best, the roads and bridges that facilitate food deliveries may soon be impassable due to the mud and rock slides that accompany the weather. 5 regions in Sudan are officially under famine conditions, and experts estimate that a further 8 million people will soon be under threat of starvation. According to the World Food Program, over 24 million people in Sudan are currently facing severe food insecurity. On top of all of this, the loss of USAID funding makes the usual assistance untenable, with many organizations simply lacking the resources and manpower to keep up with supply and demand. No USAID means that for many refugees, safe food, clean water, and medical supplies are not coming. Unfortunately, the neighboring regions to Sudan are not in a state where they can reasonably support a sudden influx of desperate people. South Sudan and Chad are both in similar states of distress, being battered by climate change and unable to cope. Ethiopia is likewise facing extreme shortages and an epidemic of malnutrition, and again, the loss of USAID has shuttered several programs dedicated to providing supplemental foods for the starving population. Egypt is also contending with uncertainty owing to the conflict in nearby Israel and Gaza. Yemen is in a civil war and facing targeted bombing campaigns. And Saudi Arabia is the previous holder of the worst humanitarian crisis title as of only a few years ago. Sudan and its surrounding nations make up one of the poorest and most heavily impacted areas of the world, and there is nowhere safe to turn. Hawkeye spoke no lie when he said that war is worse than hell, and what we see in Sudan demonstrates this quite clearly. A humanitarian crisis of this magnitude is difficult to grapple with. The destruction of crucial funding programs and the total breakdown of order make it nearly impossible to provide these refugees with the supplies and care that they so desperately need. In reading firsthand accounts of the war in Sudan and the conditions faced by these refugees, I was struck with heartache. Women whose stories I read spoke of passing through checkpoints, walking past bodies in the road, and trying to keep their children from crying as they made their way past soldiers, hostile soldiers holding guns. One woman spoke of being molested by an armed man who held her son at gunpoint and later arrested him for speaking up on his mother's behalf. This is a minor child, only 8 years old. Now, she was able to find her boy again and bring him to the relative safety of a refugee camp, but only after weeks of searching and enduring beatings and humiliation for their entire family. Other people spoke of having their families ripped apart, unable to leave the country themselves as parents, but sending their children away from the war to keep them safe and be raised by other people. One woman spoke of the horror of finding out that a young man, who tried to help protect her when she was accosted in the street, was murdered by armed men after she made her way home to her children. She wondered if it was because of her. These stories bring home the reality of life in a war zone better than the cold, hard statistics and numbers ever could. Even though this is happening on the other side of the world, to people you and I will likely never meet, it doesn't matter. We know these are real people, facing real tragedies and enduring far worse nightmares than many of us can even imagine. They need our help. Now, I chose to donate to help support UNICEF's drive to help feed and provide for the children who were displaced by the war in Sudan. And I encourage our listeners to give what they can when they can. Even a little bit can go further than you think. And without USAID, every dollar counts. UNICEF, the Sudanese Red Crescent, and the UNHCR are all good organizations that are working on the ground in Sudan to help as many people as possible. They are drowning under the flood of hunger, disease, and catastrophe, but they are working as hard as they can with what little they have. Please consider supporting one of these organizations today and raising awareness about the crisis in Sudan. The people of Sudan deserve a chance at a life of peace. Now, more than ever, it is vital to remember. Solidarity wins. Thank you for listening. Back to Terry.
All right. So, I want to thank Sam for that wonderful insight into the civilian side of the war. Now, I've been to war zones a couple of times during my long military career. I hope no one ever has to endure such chaos and deprivation. But we all know about people around the world who are, thanks to the media, or lack thereof in this case, and in Gaza. Today, we want to bring awareness to the plight of all these helpless people struggling to survive the atrocities being committed against them by these ruthless soldiers. Atrocities such as mass rape of women and children, mass killings in so-called refugee camps, the constant displacement of innocent people trying to escape the fighting, and so on. Now, I'm not going to give you any more statistics. I gave you a bunch early on. She just gave you a bunch. So you have a pretty good idea how many millions of people we're talking about here. The whole part of this whole area and part of Africa has been in near continuous warfare for decades now. And this is just another part of a bigger picture. The bigger picture of climate change that started there decades ago. For as long as a lot of people can remember now, the Horn of Africa that encompasses Ethiopia, Somalia, Chad, and parts of southern Libya, southern Egypt, has been in a state of warfare over a lack of basic resources for the people and a selling off of the mineral resources to the West, which only benefits those corrupt warlords strong enough to hold on to the rights to these resources. Rarely do any of the proceeds of these sales of minerals make it down to the ordinary people. This has been an issue for the West. This area is high-value real estate for the West, especially the U.S., beyond the minerals they can extract, which really isn't that much. The U.S. has had a base in Djibouti since right after 9/11, Camp Lemonnier. There has been increased tension there since the Chinese started building a base back there in early 2016. That and the African Horn is a good staging area for combat operations in the Middle East and Central Africa. All of this fighting going on in the neighborhood has to be making the Americans very nervous. Not to mention the loss of corporate revenues, as it's too dangerous to exploit any of the wealth due to all the factional fighting. All of which makes it harder for the humanitarian organizations trying to desperately help all those surviving refugees with food, water, and shelter to provide much needed relief. We in the West need to pay attention to this, as this could be coming to a region closer to home in the U.S. soon. The Southwest region of North America. Imagine what humanitarian crisis a limited war with Mexico would create. A refugee crisis like what's happening in Sudan right now. Add to that a severe water shortage, which is already happening right now, and you have a mirror of Sudan, Ethiopia, and Somalia right here in North America. Given what Trump's doing to the federal agencies and pissing off his neighboring countries, this scenario isn't too hard to imagine anymore. After my break, I offer you the next chapter of The Priest to paint an image of this story a little better for you if this happens in North America. I want to take this minute to explain how you can support this podcast and advertise my book. The podcast is free and can be found on these major mobile podcast apps, on my YouTube channel, and my Substack page at Crown of Beha, the Tree of Life at Substack.com. To help defray my cost, I'm asking for donations of any amount so everyone has an opportunity to watch or listen to this podcast anywhere in the world. I set up a donations tab at rss.com on the Village Oak Tree and on my website at www.crownofbeehaw.com, and I'll link to PayPal for your security. This way you can use any currency you wish from around the world, providing PayPal is available to you in your country. So now let me tell you about my book. Fugitives in the New United States, which can be found on all major online book retailers around the world, comes in hardcover, paperback, and ebook version. You don't want to wait for them to print you one. You can also buy a hardcover or paperback edition from me directly through the bookstore page of my website, and I'll ship it right out to you. This is a dystopian fiction about what the United States might look like by 2031 under a Christian theocracy. It's full of drama, action, and romance, set against a backdrop of U.S. societal collapse. The story follows a trio of resistance fighters as they navigate across Upper New England in their quest to escape from the authoritarian regime. So that's all I have here, and I appreciate any effort you can to support this endeavor that I'm doing, no matter how small it may be. Thank you very much. All right, welcome back. Now I'm going to read to you this next chapter here. Hang tight. Let me pull this up. I'll make it bigger for you here so you can maybe read along a little bit. This is The Priest, formerly known as Bob, part 23 by Michael Campy. Looking out from my lonely room. Okay, so it's not just my room because we're all in here and there are no windows. So technically, I can't be looking out. Don't get all semantic on me. It's the apocalypse. Dolly was standing in the dim light at the bottom of the stairs. The sound of someone rattling the doorknob upstairs that dragged me from my slumber. I sat up and Dolly turned and put his finger to his lips. Whoever was upstairs continued to rattle a doorknob as if a locked door somehow confused them, and then they knocked. Dolly looked at me with a slight smile and mouthed the words, "What the fuck?" We didn't answer. We heard them talking about whether they really wanted to search the whole town or if they should just go back and tell Kurtz that there was no one here. They walked off, their voices getting quieter the further away they got. Dolly went silently up the stairs and stayed against the wall as he peeked out the curtainless window. "They're gone," he said as he came back down to the basement. "Can you believe they knocked? What kind of idiot knocks in the apocalypse?" "A very special kind of idiot," I said. Tiki sat up and said, "What are you guys talking about?" "Idiots," I told him. Stuffy pulled off the sleeping bag and said, "There were idiots here?" "Yeah," I told him. "They knocked on the door." "What kind of idiot knocks on the door in apocalypse?" "A very special kind of idiot." Dolly began packing things up. "Let's get out of here. Did the guy say something about someone named Kurtz? Maybe he's the leader and we didn't kill the right person." Poor woke up and said, "I heard them talk about a Kurtz person, but no one seems to have ever seen him. He said he stays in the downstairs vault at the hotel and never comes out. They seem scared of him." We'll just have to kill him when the time comes," said Dolly. We packed up the carts and lugged them up the stairs. Dolly went out first to make sure the idiots had left. "We're good up here. They must not have lingered long enough in the corporate team building workshop to learn about clearing a house of enemy combatants." "Are we enemy combatants?" asked Stuffy. "I always kind of wanted to be an enemy combatant." "You'll have to settle for being an enemy idiot," said Dolly. "Why do you always have to squash people's dreams?" "I guess it's just what I do. I'm a dream squasher. Come on. We got miles to go before we sleep, and I'm not sure if I want to find out what kind of person this Kurtz is." We headed out. It was only around 90 degrees, so fairly cool. The desert air was clear, and it took most of the night before we finally left the lights of Las Vegas in the past. We had decided to cut up the 395 and then head west onto 50 near Lake Tahoe. There were still a lot of little towns along the way, and places in the Sierras might still harbor life. After our last encounters with humans, we weren't too excited about seeing any more of them, but it might be unavoidable. Humans can't live with them, can't shoot them in the head, or maybe we can, because all the rules have changed. So that's all I have for everybody this week. So I appreciate everybody enjoying and listening and watching our show about Sudan today. I hope you enjoyed it. You'll return again next week for something else. I'm sure I'll find something that's making the world crazy next week. Please like, subscribe, reply, and share the videos or audio podcasts wherever you watch and listen. The goal here is to resist the people who want to take our freedoms away from us. I appreciate everyone around the world, no matter who or where you are. Together, using independent media like this, we can resist authoritarian oligarchs. As I say goodbye this week, I wish to leave you with another quote, and this one's from a young Afghan woman. You may not remember her, but her name is Malala Yousafzai. I think I said that right. So her quote is, "When the whole world is silent, even one voice becomes powerful." Tlongo Foil.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.